So this past Friday, I got in the car, headed out to Beit Shemesh, picked up good friend Jim Long, and we headed to Holon, Israel, to interview archaeologist David Usishkin. He's retired now from Tel Aviv University, but he has a lot to inform this generation of archaeologists. He has a lot to say, and he has a lot on his mind. Join us for another Landmines Road Trip. So we're here in Holon. We're talking with Professor David Usishkin, who has had a long and, I would say, storied career in archaeology. And what prompted you to get into archaeology? What was the spur that pushed you to be involved with archaeology?
I was interested in archaeology since my boyhood. I was always interested in what happened in the past, in history, and I used to walk a lot and go to museums. My father was interested in it. Anyway, when I finished my army service, I decided to study in the Hebrew University. I really didn't know what to do and what to study. So I decided eventually to decide by way of elimination, to eliminate what I don't want to study. And I remained with law and archaeology. And then I decided to choose archaeology rather than law. It sounded much more interesting, and you don't have to sit in the office the whole day, and there is no pressure of clients and so on. And I never regretted this decision.
Who did you study with at the Hebrew University?
At the Hebrew University at the time, there were a few grand old men, Benjamin Mazar, and Michael Aviona, and Avigad, of course. But the main figure was Yigael Yadin, who just started his career at the time. And I studied with him. I did my MA thesis under his supervision, and also my doctoral thesis under his supervision.
What was your doctoral thesis at?
At the time when I studied, it was still before the Six-Day War, and Israel was completely isolated from the rest of the Near East. And I thought that I should do something which is not exactly associated with archaeology of Israel, but to try and break this to force my way through this isolation. So eventually I decided on Hittite art, ancient Hittite art, on Hittite sculptures. And this was the subject of my study. And of course I could go to Turkey and to all the various European museums and study there. Also, I don't like pottery and working with Hittite sculptures. There was no pottery involved. And again, I never regretted the subject. And for many years, still now, I'm also studying and working in the field of Hittite art.
Were you in Hattusha?
Not in Hattusha. I was working on what we call Neo-Hittite art, which is Iron Age sculptures, Iron Age cities. They are mainly in southern Turkey and northern Syria. But of course, Hattusha is involved with all its sculptures and monuments.
Right. Recently, there's been, on a side topic, because he mentioned Hittite art, a number of sites in Turkey, but one in particular,
Göbekli.
Yes, Göbekli, that has monumental columns and with engravings of animals that change our understanding of the ancient world to some degree.
I visited Göbekli. It's an amazing site, no doubt, but it all goes back to pre-pottery times, to the 8th, 7th millennia BC. nothing to do with what I'm doing now.
Right. No, but it's fascinating.
Fantastic and fascinating site. If you have the opportunity to visit it, go ahead.
Right. But it certainly changes our understanding of ancient peoples and cultures and reframes the dating of the ancient world to some degree.
Oh, yes, sure. Yeah. Because it shows how developed civilization was already in this early period, much earlier than we would have thought.
So when the Bible talks about the Hittites being in Hebron, right, for example, are they talking about the same Hittites?
Probably. There are some here and there, some mentions of Hittites in the Bible. Sure, there are the Hittites from the north. Whether there was really a Hittite in Hebron or not, that's a different
question. No one showed that yet.
Different question.
Right. So who are your inspirations in your early days in the university? Was it Yigal Yadin? Was it Aharoni? Who were your inspirations that...
My main inspiration, as I already mentioned, was Yadin, I think. I worked with Yadin. I worked with him in Chatzor. I worked with him in Masada, of course. Also in Megiddo. My first connection with Megiddo was my participation in his first dig there in 1st January 1960. So you see how long I'm connected to this site. But mainly, of course, in the cave of the letters in the Judean desert.
Right.
Yadin certainly was a great man. But eventually I decided, let's put it this way, to become independent. So I left Jerusalem and went to Tel Aviv.
Well, maybe talk a little bit about the differences between the world of archaeology from Hebrew University and how is Tel Aviv University different in its approach to archaeology?
I don't think it was... It's very difficult to define this question. But still today, there are a lot of differences. It starts with a background. If you walk in Jerusalem on Friday night, and you walk in Tel Aviv on Friday night in the street, you see exactly the difference in attitude, the difference in people, what they do, how they spend the Friday night, and so on. Tel Aviv is always more open, less religious, less conservative in any way, and of course a more commercial city. This is also expressed in the universities. The Hebrew University is a great institution, but at least the Faculty of Humanities is very conservative in approach, very respectable, of course, very good. Tel Aviv is more open, I think, less conservative, less concerned with the effects of the past, with traditions, and this, of course, is expressed in everything. Also, in the type of students.
In Megiddo, you partnered with Israel Finkelstein.
Yes. Right?
And he's kind of taken a position as the voice, the non-traditional voice in archaeology. And he said to me in Megiddo last year, he said, but you know, the dating has come closer. Right now there's 30 years between the high chronology and the low chronology that separates me and Ami Mazar. And I think if you didn't have Israel Finkelstein in the world of archaeology, you'd have to invent him. Because he pushes the envelope, you know, he pushes people to have to examine. And I've seen him tear apart some archaeologists who don't do their homework as well as Israel does.
Well, no doubt Israel Finkelstein is a very gifted person. And I worked with him at Megiddo 20 years, and I can say only good things about him as leader of the expedition. However, his attitude is very questionable on many things. The question is basically, what is the attitude of the archaeologist to the Bible? That's how it all starts. And let me explain it. There is, on the one hand, what I call the Albrightian school, people who follow the traditions of Albright, and they're all over the States, you can find them. And you can find them in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, which is, let us say, the citadel, the fortress of Albrightianism in Israel. What the Albright system was very simple. He believed in the Bible. He believed in the truth of the Bible. And he believed that in the facts told in the Bible and explained in the Bible as the basis of work. Now you go to archaeology and you find some facts here and there which still don't fit together a whole, don't somehow create a whole picture, but there are bits and pieces. So like a jigsaw puzzle, you stick the facts you found to the picture, to the overall biblical picture. So that's one attitude. Now, there are some people in Tel Aviv who think on the opposite way, that you have to separate between Bible and archaeology. There is, we know enough now about archaeology that we can build up some kind of a picture on the basis of the archaeological facts, and there is a Bible, and you have to separate these two disciplines if you have to try and get to the truth. Now, there are some people in Tel Aviv who think like that, and but they have a different attitude. Well, so the question is, what do you do? How you connect
the two worlds of archaeology and the Bible?
Archaeology versus the Bible. So I believe it should be separated. I believe, in fact, I go to the extreme. I'm saying an archaeologist is a technician. He should deal with archaeology. He should present his facts. And that's the biblical scholars quarrel about all this. Now, Israel is different. Israel Finkelstein believed that he could correct the Bible through archaeology. That he could take the archaeological facts as he interprets them, which, and he believes that his interpretation is okay, and then he will correct the Bible. He'll deal with the Persian period and say that this and that and that, that there is no in this and this and that places there are no archaeological remains. Hence, the text connected to these places must be very late, for instance. But I don't think that's a good attitude. And eventually, what he does today is simply what Albright did at the time, simply to mix up archaeology and Bible, and mixes archaeology as a mixture. It doesn't work neither archaeologically, not biblically. And all his school or his followers in Tel Aviv, or his people who go with him, Nadav Neiman, Mr. Lipschitz, they are all doing the same kind of thing. Now, the problem is you can't separate completely the archaeological facts from the Bible. You take the case of Jezreel, for instance. Jezreel is the basis for all Israel Finkelstein's chronology. But we forget that the dating of Jezreel is based on a biblical verse telling us that King Omri built a new capital in Samaria, and the whole story of Jezebel. And, so on the one hand, you rely on the Bible. On the other hand, you try to do something independent. It's very difficult, and I don't have any solution. But to tell you the truth, I'm trying to do my archaeological work, and of course I try to connect it with the Bible, but I don't consider myself a biblical scholar. I'm not trying to correct the Bible or anything. And for me, the Bible, first of all, is a source of inspiration. When I worked in Jezreel, for instance, I loved the figure of Queen Jezebel, and I always thought about this lady, considered her a courageous lady. You will not find a lady who is condemned more or less to death, who will beautify herself and challenge her killers the way Jezebel did. And when I worked in Lachish, of course, the whole question of Sennacherib and the Sennacherib campaign, and Hezekiah gave me a lot of inspiration, and so forth and so forth.
What would you say was the most exciting excavation that you've been a part of?
You ask about my most exciting excavation. This was when I was still a student, the Cave of the Letters. I think the cave of the Letters, working. I was Yadin's assistant, chief assistant in the Cave of the Letters. And nobody expected anything from this cave. But this fantastic place, this fantastic desert, there's a whole background story, everything which connected with it. And then the way the whole excavation rolled forward, one discovery
after another,
followed the other, one step after the other, things which nobody ever have dreamt about. This was something fantastic and fantastically unusual. Something I'm afraid not to be repeated in the future anywhere.
Would you continue an excavation in Qumran, in that area? Do you think there's more to be discovered there?
No, everything was done already. Uh-huh. Well, now they are working here, working there, so they find a small piece of inscription, but that's nothing mm-hmm. compared with these stories.
The amount of cultural material that came out of those excavations is astonishing. I mean, it's just an enormous amount. What we learned about textiles, what we learned about the way people lived is...
Everything. That's a source of information.
Nothing to compare with it.
Unbelievable.
Right. Those excavations in the desert... And I would say probably in terms of the Dead Sea Scrolls more than anything else, there was a movement for a long time to try to associate that with the early origins of Christianity. Do you have a particular insight in that regard?
No.
You don't?
I know hardly anything about these problems.
Uh-huh.
Dead Sea Scrolls is completely a different field.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about Lachish for a little bit. Lachish was a virgin excavation when you started there, if I understand correctly.
No, Lachish was excavated already in the
1930s.
Right.
McAllister?
Starkey.
Starkey. Right.
This was the largest British excavations ever carried out in the Holy Land in the 1930s. Starkey did a lot of work, and on a wholesale excavation, you can call it, enormous materials, enormous works. He worked 6 years with many hundreds of workers, And it ended very tragically when Mr. Starkey was simply murdered by Arab bandits when he traveled to Jerusalem to the opening of the Rockefeller Museum. In 1973, when I started to build up an excavation, there were a number of candidates, and a number of sites, which I had to choose from. And eventually I decided on Lachish, because I thought the work was, good work was left in the middle. Olga Tafnan, Starkey's assistant, published all the material, so all was published. There were the famous reliefs, of course, the biblical connections, the story of the campaign. And again, I never regretted a minute that I went to Lachish. We somehow used all Starkey's material to continue the work. We did quite a good work. And,
how many seasons did you dig in Lachish?
We worked in Lachish officially, I think, 11 seasons. And then we stopped. And then we did some restoration work in the gate, so we continued the work in the gate. And then the park authorities started to make some preparations for turning Lachish into a park, so we worked some more. But we stopped because we were moving to earlier periods, which were less interesting to me. And there was accumulation of material which had to be published, so we just stopped.
Uh-huh. And now Hebrew University is going to continue the Lachish excavation.
Yes, Mr. Garfinkel wants to continue.
Do you have any advice for them? In terms
He asked me to be his expedition's advisor. I happily agreed, why not? He's trying to concentrate on periods which were not exhausted in my excavation, mainly the beginning of the Iron Age. He's interested, after his work in Kayafa, in the 10th century, 9th century. I wish he will succeed. Let's wait and see. He goes also, he wants to go to the parts of the mound which I didn't dig.
You have a world full of very talented and knowledgeable people. And as opposed to biology, and even in biology or in physics, you have tremendous differences of opinion about the science. And archaeology is a very interpretive science. Right, it's going from being a very interpretive science to bringing more and more scientific techniques into the field. Bar Ilan is doing it, and Tel Aviv is doing it. I don't know if Hebrew University is doing it as much. Intuition of the archaeologist, the experience of the archaeologist, is taking on a less prominent component of the excavation, it seems.
I'm afraid you are a bit naive.
I may be, so I'd like you to inform me.
Yeah. Interpretation now is much worse than it was, and it's, I'm afraid, becoming worse. First of all, there is now much more public relations in archaeology. The archaeologist must speak to the press, must make all kinds of press releases, must make himself known in the world. All the younger archaeologists, mostly they don't have positions, proper positions, so they have to make a lot of public relations in order to get eventually some university or museum position and so on. So all this is connected also with interpretation. All archaeology and archaeological work in the field depends on stratigraphy. And the stratigraphy is, in fact, an interpretation. And perhaps it's in a way that there are some more techniques. So you measure the elevation of some objects. So it's not 22 centimeters, so it becomes 22.4 centimeters. But this is not what counts. Now, as to the sciences, all these sciences, which to us look wonderful and so on, are also matters of interpretation. They all deal now with carbon-14. Carbon-14 checking tests became the fashion. In fact, I'm the pioneer of carbon-14 in biblical sites. Lachish was the first site where there were carbon-14 tests made in the Iron Age. But now everything is carbon-14. You think carbon-14 is not interpretation. You think these people who deal with it are gods almighty. To us, they look wonderful. But then again, everything changes from year to year, from people to people. You take low chronology business. You take Bichai Mazar and Israel Finkelstein, who quarreled about the things. They use the same carbon-14 tests, the same. And each one uses it for his own chronology. So what do you say? So I don't think it's that easy. Archaeology basically remains the same. And if you take out the public relations and you take out the interpretations, it's not that easy, and things didn't change much. I'll give you some example, the best example to what I told you before about archaeology versus Bible. I think in the biblical period, the best case is Solomonic Jerusalem. On the one hand, there is the old Brightian school, and there are some extreme figures in this school, mainly all the Hebrew university people. You take Mrs. Nat Mazar and so on. Now, Nat Mazar is a very good field archaeologist, a very good one, and she's a good friend of mine. I admire her work professionally, I'm talking. But then it comes to interpretation. So she's typical. These people believe that you take the story of the Bible as facts. And as I told you before, you take the facts on the ground and add them as jigsaw puzzle pieces. So they believe that the Solomonic Jerusalem was a great place, a fortified city. So they find the city, they take some piece of a wall and put it there because due to the existence of the text. Now you take me and people like me or us in Tel Aviv, so we go to the facts and we start from the fact. This is our starting point. And of course we don't see any Palace of David, and we don't see any Solomonic wall, and we don't see any big Solomonic city. We see a very humble village in the center of City of David. So my attitude is, this is, you have here some settlement in the City of David, that's small. This creates some problems with the Bible. I agree. I respect the biblical text. I'm not going to solve it. I'm turning to the biblical scholars and say, these are the facts. Do with it what you want. But I'm not mixing it up with this question with my archaeological facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Only time will justify one approach or the other, and probably at the end of the day, which you might agree to, is that there's going to have to be mutual respect. One of the things I think that I've seen is that many of the younger archaeologists don't even know the Bible. So even where the Bible might be able to inform on the context of a particular, the locations, the cities, the geography that's involved, very often the younger generation of archaeologists often don't know those classical references that might help to inform the progress of an excavation, not because the people and the specifics of the story are true, but because the circumstances. The biblical authors clearly understood the context that they're describing. They were people of the land. They're people who knew the cultures. Now, sometimes they may be writing about periods that were earlier than them, but very often they were talking about things that, at least in their times, were relatively accurate in describing the circumstances, the context of the biblical events. And as I think as time goes on, we are discovering more and more that the context is more or less accurate. Would you agree with that?
Of course, the more material we have, the better. Of course, it's easier to make a complete picture. Still, we are far, far off from getting a clear-cut picture of what happened and how it happened. Take Lachish, for instance. Lachish in around 1130 BC was destroyed completely. Destroyed. Total destruction. Such a destruction that the place was abandoned completely for 200 years or so. Now, who did it? Simple question. Who is responsible for coming to Lachish, which was then one of the greatest Canaanite cities in the country, and destroying it completely? We don't have the answer to that because we don't...
Nobody spoke about
any,
it.
Any inscriptions. Okay. We don't know. Right. We destroyed Chatzor in the...
we have a destruction there in Lachish.
We have a destruction.
We have it. So what does the cultural evidence say about the destruction of Lachish?
What do you mean by cultural evidence?
In other words, do we have arrowheads? Do we have... some...
No, there are no arrowheads. Simply everything is arrowheads, hardly any. And this was still in the period when probably if they shot arrowheads, they then collected them because the metal was very expensive.
To reuse them.
But you simply see the place destroyed. A great city. One of the largest in the country, one of the most prosperous in the country, destroyed. Are these Israelites, as told in the book of Joshua? I don't know. Are these sea peoples? I believe that these are the sea peoples, the Philistine, quite possibly. You take Megiddo. In Megiddo, at the end of the 11th or the beginning of the 10th century, was again, this was still a Canaanite city. It was destroyed completely. A great question, who destroyed it? So some traditionalists would say King David conquered it. There are people who believe that it was not destroyed by an enemy, but it was an earthquake. Well, what do you say? Again, we know nothing.
And that's very important. That's very important. I think you're saying it right, is that where there isn't information... to say it's okay to say we don't know yet. We don't know yet. We could suggest, we could hypothesize, but very often what the press likes, what the media likes, they want a story and they want hard information. And they will, if even if you make a suggestion, they will spin that into being the story.
Yes, true, but that's what I complained before, that
right.
Public relations plays a bigger part.
But the truth is, it's an important part because that's how digs get funded very often. In other words, if I want to raise money for my excavation and budgets are limited and I'm competing with other excavations and other agendas, so there's a limited amount of resources out there. The government doesn't really fund anything other than salvage excavations.
All this is true, but it doesn't help...
the academics, it doesn't help...
academic. I always compared archaeology in a way, to work of a detective. A detective goes and investigates a murder case. Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective are my good examples. So it's the same problem. They have to work, not in the middle of public engagement lights, but to work slowly and get all the facts, and then present the facts to a jury, to a judge, and he is the one who has to judge. And once, if you read all these detective stories, if you see that the police officer starts with press releases and so on, always things are distorted.
Mm-hmm. Of the excavations that are going on now currently in the country, what's the most interesting to you? Which excavation do you think is the most intriguing?
That's
too general?
Very, very difficult. Very difficult to answer. But you are talking, of course, of the biblical period.
Not only. I think there's some fascinating excavations that are going on that are not just from the biblical period. I think the Byzantine period has tremendous potential. I like the work of Guy Stiebel, and he's, you know, which is not, I mean, it's the new, maybe the New Testament period, but it's not the, you know, Bible as, you know, from the Jewish point of view. There are some things going on that I think are interesting. What interests you?
I would say Elat Mazar's dig in Jerusalem is very interesting, which in my view it all connects not to Solomon but to the later part of the Iron Age, but that's a different story. It's a good dig. Mm-hmm. There are tremendous structures there and tremendous discoveries that's very important and very interesting. I was interested in Hatzor. I was interested in Hatzor. And of course, for many years, also now in the Megiddo, I think, which is basically a very important and very, very interesting
site. It's an amazing site. I mean, and one of the things that I, as an educator, am always concerned with is how does a site communicate and share its story, share its messages? So from an educational point of view now, right, what would you say are the top three educational sites, archaeological sites in the country?
There is, of course, Megiddo, which is a difficult site. It's difficult to understand. But the advantage of Megiddo, beyond being a very important site, as you mentioned, it also has a variety. It's a very versatile site. There are things and structures from different periods, and a visitor can come and see how archaeology developed, how archaeological remains developed, how history developed on a single site. This, of course, I believe Lachish, if they ever do the restorations and finish it, it will be a fantastic site. But that's for a specific period where you can, that's the only period of the Bible. The question, I'm talking about the 8th century BC, about Sennacherib's campaign, where really the Bible and the biblical period come alive. Suddenly you can combine everything. You have the biblical text, you have all the story of what happened, how Sennacherib came, Hezekiah, Isaiah, all these figures, etc. So you have the documentation, you have the Assyrian documentation, of course, the Assyrian others. Then you have the site, you see the city, you see all the remains of the Assyrian attack, is this sea dredge, which is the only sea dredge from this period known today. It's the only Assyrian sea dredge. You can follow the siege and the attack. And finally, of course, there's a relief. The relief is like some modern photographer who came and took photographs of everything. All this together combines to create a very, very unique picture, if properly presented, of course, which is not easy.
Right.